steeply declines. An extra year of foreign language has a higher payoff than the combined effect of an extra year of math and an extra year of science. Later researchers usually detect a bigger payoff for math, but not science. One pair of researchers finds that extra high school math raises pay for female college graduates. For males and less educated women, however, the payoff for extra math is unclear. Another research team reports that, correcting for ability, the following courses increase adult earnings. Algebra, geometry, plus 1.9% higher income. Average English, plus 1.5%. English literature, plus 1.5%. Above-level English, plus 2.5%, and foreign language, plus 1.6%. In Britain, high school students who attain the A level in math earn almost 10% extra 6 years after graduation. However, natural science is no more lucrative than humanities or social science. The most optimistic estimate of the benefit of high school math finds that Danish students who were nudged into advanced math eventually earned 21% more. The reason? Students who take advanced math are more likely to go to college. Danes who took advanced math without upping their educational ambitions reaped little or no gain. Overall, these are not the patterns a devotee of the wheat-chaff theory should expect. Yes, math classes probably pay extra, but natural science classes probably don't. Yes, English courses sometimes seem lucrative, but foreign language courses consistently seem lucrative. A stubborn fan of the wheat-chaff theory could declare that physics is a Mickey Mouse subject and French is a real subject. The natural explanation, though, is that the wheat-chaff theory is overblown, since employers value diplomas, and diplomas require chaff. Chaff pays. Wheat, chaff, and major. Wheat-chaff theory is right about one thing. Major matters. Engineering majors are near the top of the financial pecking order. Business majors are roughly average. Education majors are near the bottom. The massive American Community Survey measures earnings for every college major you've heard of, and many you haven't. Fortunately for education majors, the average college premium is high. In the American Community Survey, college grads earn 78% more than high school grads. Business, the most common major, is roughly average. So while a pessimist could report business majors earn 40% more than education majors, an optimist could with equal accuracy insist education majors earn 27% more than high school graduates. As usual, don't take these numbers at face value. The major premium, like the college premium, steeply falls after correcting for ability. Strong students tend to major in high-earning subjects. Natural science majors, for example, outshine social science and humanities majors on the math and verbal sections of the SAT. To measure the true effect of majoring in engineering rather than education, you need to correct for standardized test scores, high school grades, math background, and so on. When researchers make these vital corrections, the college major payoff falls by about half. Take engineering. On a naive reading, the average education major would make 75% more money by switching to engineering, but the average education major's SAT scores, high school GPA, and math preparation say otherwise. How much extra would the average education major who switched really earn? Estimates from 10 separate papers range from plus 25% to plus 60%, with an average of plus 44%. These corrected figures are actually optimistic because they take the education major's ability to complete the engineering curriculum for granted. In practice, even eager engineering students frequently flee to easier majors. When I was an undergrad at UC Berkeley, a popular T-shirt read, "As the limit of GPA approaches zero, go to poli-sci." Ex-engineering students failed to see the humor. In any case, a proper test of the wheat-chaff theory shouldn't compare high-earning college majors to low-earning college majors. Since the wheat-chaff theory claims that chaff is worthless in the job market, a proper test should compare low-earning college majors to high school grads. The wheat-chaff theory is believable if you focus on the best-paid majors. To test wheat-chaff, though, you should scroll to worst-paid majors. Result? The least lucrative majors in the student handbook command an earnings premium of roughly 20%. Many widely ridiculed majors, anthropology, archaeology, English, liberal arts, sociology, history, communications, boost earnings by around 30%. Political scientists earn about as much as business students, and both slightly out-earn biologists. For an economics professor, the most vivid strike against the wheat-chaff theory is that econ majors earn almost as much as engineers. I assure you that my profession makes near zero effort to train our undergrads for the job market. We're easy on our students, even at elite schools like Berkeley and Princeton. Frankly, most econ professors practice a variant of the old Soviet adage, "We pretend to teach, they pretend to learn." During 4 years of study, our better students acquire only two marketable skills, elementary statistics and ability to calculate a present discounted value. How, then, do economists fill 8 semesters of coursework? With watered-down versions of topics that fascinate the faculty. Supply and demand problems, mathematical economics, economic growth, and a long list of fields that are far less applied than they sound. Macroeconomics, industrial organization, labor economics, regulation, public choice, economic history. From the standpoint of job skills, an economics degree is almost entirely chaff, except for budding economics professors. Yet despite our failure to prepare econ majors for their careers, the job market treats our graduates like engineers. To be fair to the wheat-chaff theory, economics is an outlier. The most lucrative majors tend to be vocational. Engineers and computer scientists rule the roost, and finance, accounting, and nursing aren't far behind. Yet the fact remains, students can major in underwater basket weaving, enjoy a 4-year party, and reasonably expect to out-earn peers who said, "I'm not going to college because it's a waste of time," by 25%. Wheat, chaff, and mismatch. How closely related is your job to your major? About 55% of college graduates say closely related, 25% say somewhat related, and 20% say not related. Ego presumably skews these answers. Who wants to confess their job and their major are not related? Yet the responses are meaningful. People who admit to mismatch earn 10 to 12% less than the typical person in their major. The more vocational the major, the lower the mismatch risk. While all these facts are consistent with the wheat-chaff theory, there's one telling discrepancy. The market penalty for mismatch is greater for more vocational subjects. Mismatched engineers and computer scientists earn over 20% less. Mismatched health professions majors earn almost 30% less. For less vocational majors, in contrast, the mismatch penalty is roughly zero. Mismatched English and foreign language majors earn about 1% less. Mismatched philosophy and religion majors earn 20% extra. To capture the full benefit of a real major, you need a job that uses your training. To capture the full benefit of a Mickey Mouse major, in contrast, you need only a job that requires a degree. And contrary to the wheat-chaff theory, the full benefit of Mickey Mouse majors is nothing to laugh at. Comedian Jay Leno is probably the most famous promoter of the wheat-chaff theory. In college, philosophy majors study if the glass is half full or is the glass half empty. See? This prepares them for careers later as waiters. Leno's not entirely wrong. Philosophy is a low-paid major, and some philosophy majors do indeed wait tables. Statistically, though, Leno overstates. The average philosophy BA earns almost 30% more than an equally able worker who never went to college. The degree may not help you do a better job, but still helps you get a better job. And there's nothing special about philosophy. Studying anything pays more than studying nothing. Is credentialism a creature of the state? Why do employers reward useless education? The signaling model assumes they do so of their own free will. Firms filter on credentials because credentials are the most cost-effective way to tell good workers from bad. Some argue, however, that government is ultimately to blame. Maybe useless education pays because good government jobs require credentials. Maybe useless education pays because good jobs require occupational licenses, and government limits such licenses to people with credentials. Maybe useless education pays because government persecutes IQ testing, forcing employers to rely on credentials instead. How do such stories fare against the facts? Government credentialism. Some third world governments employ the vast majority of their country's educated workers. In the 1960s, Egypt notoriously guaranteed every college graduate a government job. By 1988, two-thirds of Egypt's male college graduates and 80% of its female college graduates worked in the public sector. Throughout the world, public sector workers tend to be more educated than private sector workers. In the United States, 52% of government employees have a bachelor's degree or more versus 34% for private employees. Government positions for high school dropouts have all but vanished. Between 1960 and 2000, the fraction of American public sector workers who hadn't finished high school dropped from 34% to 3%. If government credentialism really explained the payoff for useless education, we would expect the education premium to be higher in the public than the private sector. When government pays the educated more than they're worth, private employers need not follow suit. Business could instead scoff, if government wants credentialed workers so badly, it can have them. Indeed, if government credentialism artificially inflates the education premium, refusing to match inflated government salaries is the profit-maximizing response. In the real world, however, the private sector values education more than the public sector. Researchers consistently find that government pay scales are compressed. Governments overpay the least educated workers and underpay the most educated workers. The U.S. federal government is a case in point. Public debate focuses primarily on the issue, do we overpay federal workers? On average, the answer is clearly yes, but do we overpay federal workers for credentials is a distinct question, and the answer is no. The least educated federal workers hit the jackpot, yet once they're on the federal payroll, the extra rewards for credentials are modest. In the federal government, the average college grad makes $18.10 per hour more than the average worker who never went to college, a 46% premium. In the private sector, the average college graduate makes $21 per hour more than the average worker who never went to college, a 73% premium. In the federal government, a professional degree doctorate gets you $16 per hour more than a bachelor's degree, a 28% pay bump. In the private sector, a professional degree doctorate gets you $39.90 per hour more than a bachelor's degree, an 80% pay bump. Researchers find similar patterns for U.S. state and local government and abroad. The rise of government unions seems a key factor. Whatever its origin, the fact remains, if the private sector adopted the civil service pay scale, education would pay less, not more. In any case, government jobs aren't numerous enough to explain why useless education pays. Yes, government is a major employer. Almost a quarter of college graduates works for federal, state, or local government. But as we saw last chapter, over three-quarters of college degrees aren't vocational. By basic arithmetic, most people with such degrees end up in the private sector. If the private sector ignored non-vocational degrees, they would be far less lucrative. Licensing. Occupational licensing is now more prevalent than union membership at its peak in the 1950s. Almost 30% of U.S. workers need a government license to legally do their jobs. The most obvious effect of licensing is to raise wages by restricting competition. While payoffs vary from job to job, the average license raises income by 10 to 15%. Why bring this up? Because education and licensing often pair up. Only 12% of high school dropouts need a license to do their jobs, versus 44% with advanced degrees. In some occupations, licenses require educational credentials. Given these facts, you could say, who needs the signaling model? Employers reward useless education because government forces them. Yet this story has a fatal flaw. The education premium dwarfs the licensing premium. Suppose licensing boosts income by 15%. Since advanced degree holders are 32 percentage points more likely to need licenses than high school dropouts, licensing should, on average, boost advanced degree holders' earnings by 5%. Even correcting for ability, however, master's degree holders earn 92% more than dropouts. Licensing has large effects on the overall labor market. The topic deserves more attention from researchers, policymakers, and voters. The case for deregulation is strong. Do we really need government to protect us from bad barbers, florists, or decorators? Yet, if occupational licensing were abolished today, the market's rewards for useless education would barely budge. IQ laundering. Human capital purists often protest, why on earth do workers signal ability with a 4-year degree instead of a 3-hour IQ test? My response? Employers reasonably fear high IQ, low education applicants' low conscientiousness and conformity. Other critics of the education industry, however, have a more streamlined response. American employers rely on educational credentials rather than IQ tests because IQ tests are effectively illegal. Thanks to the landmark 1971 Griggs versus Duke Power case, later codified in the 1991 Civil Rights Act, anyone who hires by IQ risks pricey lawsuits. Why? Because IQ tests have a disparate impact on Black and Hispanic applicants. To escape liability, employers must prove IQ testing is a business necessity. Since this legal hurdle is nigh insurmountable, employers turn to higher education to launder their workers' IQ scores. As Jonathan Last succinctly states, in Griggs, the court held that employers could not rely on IQ-type tests if minorities performed relatively poorly on them. So what employers do is this. They launder their request for test scores through the college system because colleges are allowed to use such considerations. The universities get rich, students and their parents go into hock, and everyone pretends that Acme Widgets is hiring Madison because they value her BA in sociology from Haverford, and not because her admission to Haverford proved that she is bright, a fact which a 3-hour written test could have demonstrated just as well. If Griggs were rolled back, it would upend the college system at a stroke. The IQ laundering story has a kernel of truth. Taken literally, the business necessity standard for IQ-based hiring is almost impossible to meet. Yet this argument proves too much. Taken literally, relying on diplomas to launder IQ is equally illegal. The original Griggs case explicitly ruled that both IQ tests and educational credentials have a disparate impact, so neither is permissible unless employers prove their business necessity. Yet in the real world, employers require educational credentials without bothering to prove a thing. How do employers get away with it? Because the legal system normally ignores the letter of the law. For all its bluster, Griggs bans nothing. It's more like a tax on out-of-favor hiring methods. Defenders of the IQ laundering story can't make their case by reciting the law. They have to show the tax on IQ-based hiring is steep enough to convince employers to hire educated workers for inflated prices instead of smart workers for bargain prices. At the outset, the IQ laundering story faces an awkward fact. 10-30% of large employers admit they use cognitive ability tests. The obvious retort is that without the test tax, cognitive ability tests would be much more common. How can we measure the burden of the test tax? By studying enforcement. Number of lawsuits, size of awards and settlements, legal costs, and plaintiff's chance of winning. No one has comprehensive data, but existing research yields a ballpark figure. The total number of employment discrimination cases filed in federal court peaked at about 23,000 in 1998, then gradually declined to about 14,000 in 2007. The average cash award if you win a trial is large, about $1.1 million for 1990 to 2000, but only 2% of plaintiffs actually go to trial and win. So annual awards sum to less than $600 million. Most plaintiffs, 58%, manage to get an out-of-court settlement. Settlements are usually confidential, but the average settlement is about 5% as large as the average trial award. Annual settlements, therefore, sum to less than $800 million. If plaintiffs' lawyers work for a 40% contingency fee and defense outspends them by a factor of three, employers' legal costs still sum to less than $1.7 billion. Updating these mid-1990s figures for inflation, employers' total legal burden sums to under $5 billion per year. Compared to total labor costs, $5 billion is trivial. Now remember that $5 billion is a high estimate of the cost of all employment discrimination cases. The tax on IQ testing is far smaller. Only 4% of federal discrimination cases brought between 1987 and 2003 alleged disparate impact. That amounts to under 1,000 annual cases against any form of employment testing. If disparate impact cases cost the usual amount, employers' total test tax is under $200 million a year. Compared to the total upcharge a nation of employers pays for college graduates, this is a pittance. If IQ testing really let employers hire college-quality workers for high school wages, prudent employers would freely test IQ and treat the occasional lawsuit as a minor cost of doing business. Remember, correcting for ability, college grads earn 40% more than high school grads. If IQ laundering were a central function of higher education, courts could raise the test tax 100-fold, and IQ testing would remain profitable. To the best of my knowledge, proponents of the IQ laundering story have never grappled with this arithmetic. Their main evidence is timing. The education premium started its meteoric ascent suspiciously soon after the 1971 Griggs decision. Yet on closer look, their own data show the college premium stayed flat for almost a decade. Why would it take years for the slightest hint of IQ laundering to surface? In long-run historical perspective, IQ laundering is even less credible. Employers amply rewarded college diplomas decades before discrimination laws were on the books. Between 1914 and 2005, the U.S. college premium was roughly U-shaped. High for the three decades before World War II, moderate for the three decades after World War II, then high again. By pre-war standards, today's college premium is normal. Instead of viewing the rise in the college premium as a belated response to discrimination law, why not view it as a rebound from an historic low? Proponents of the IQ laundering story should also be troubled by the labor market's lackadaisical hunt for loopholes. The world is full of covert IQ tests. Employers could replace IQ tests with tests of job knowledge, skill, or problem-solving. Don't want to leave a paper trail? Measure IQ with intellectually challenging interviews. If employers' hands are tied, ambitious applicants will gladly help them bend the rules by stapling their SATs to their applications. In every other area of the economy, costly regulations inspire creative evasion. Why not here? The most blatant flaw of all, the IQ laundering story implies the labor market will reward not college diplomas, but college admission letters. Instead of paying a college $100,000 to launder your test scores, you'd pay a $100 application fee. If you object, an admission letter signals good IQ, but skipping college signals bad character. You're back to my story. The root cause of educational signaling is the timeless problem of imperfect information, not a lawsuit from 1971. Disparate impact laws are like speed limits. Taken literally, almost every driver breaks the law. Why? Because speed limits, like disparate impact laws, are highly inconvenient and laxly enforced. If employers really wanted to test applicants' IQs, IQ-based hiring would be as common as driving 60 when the maximum is 55. We shouldn't totally dismiss IQ laundering. If disparate impact law were suddenly abolished, IQ testing might slightly expand, leading to a slightly lower education premium. Employers arguably overestimate the size of the test tax. Clear-cut legalization would calm their fears. Testing job seekers' intelligence is somewhat more common outside of the United States. Furthermore, while the average test tax is low, plenty of firms aren't average. Copyright violation is rampant, but copyright litigation still bankrupted Napster. If Walmart loudly embraced IQ testing, it might meet Napster's fate. Overall, though, IQ laundering is an extreme tail-wagging-the-dog story. The idea that employers pay hundreds of billions in extra labor costs to avoid hundreds of millions in extra legal costs is not credible. Underrating the benefits of education? Does the labor market really reward useless education? Skeptics have a long list of doubts. After careful review, many turn out to be partly valid. Yet after amply correcting for each and every doubt, education still pays, even fine arts degrees. To fairly measure the payoff of a fine arts degree, however, you can't just review the main reasons to think the degree is less lucrative than it seems on the surface. You must also review the main reasons to think the degree is more lucrative than it seems on the surface. We'll ponder intangible benefits later in the audiobook. For now, let's stick to crude materialism. Unemployment. Educated workers are, as a rule, less likely to face unemployment. Between 1972 and 2000, the average unemployment rate was almost 8% for high school dropouts, slightly under 4% for high school graduates, and about 2% for college graduates. Since the Great Recession, the media has been full of stories about college-educated workers losing their jobs and recent college graduates who can't find jobs in the first place. Yet the rule that educated workers are less jobless is as true as ever, and recent graduates are no exception. The real reason, as usual, is not whether educated workers have lower unemployment rates, but why. Ability bias takes many forms. Perhaps the well-educated were better at finding and keeping jobs before they set foot on campus. The best way to handle ability bias, once again, is to measure ability, then correct for it. Such research is sadly sparse, but one high-quality study measures the effect of Americans' education on unemployment, correcting for a host of abilities. 29% of the effect of education on unemployment vanishes once you correct for IQ. Correcting for IQ, fatalism, self-esteem, and antisocial behavior, less than half the apparent effect of education on unemployment remains. Fringe benefits. Health insurance, pensions, and other employee benefits are now almost a third of total private sector pay and over a third of total public sector pay. Better educated workers get better benefits. In the 2010 wave of the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, educated Americans are more likely to have all the following employee benefits: medical insurance, life insurance, dental insurance, parental leave, a supplemental retirement plan, flexible hours, training, and child care. Correcting for intelligence shears education's impact, but normally leaves it well above zero. Measurement. How do researchers measure people's education? The ultimate source, in most cases, is asking them, how many years of education do you have? Or, what's the highest degree you completed? Since people err and lie, all real-world education data is flawed. Education skeptics could use these undeniable flaws to dismiss everything we think we know about the payoff of education. Yet the correct statistical inference is almost the opposite. The less reliably you measure X, counterintuitively, the greater X's true effect. Ignoring mismeasurement lets competing factors steal credit from education, leading us to underestimate how valuable education really is. Imagine a world where five workers have high school diplomas and five have college degrees. Workers with high school diplomas earn $50,000 a year. Workers with college degrees earn twice as much. Yet neither high school nor college teaches students to carefully complete surveys. When the census inquires about their education, one of each group checks the wrong box. What happens? The data overstate earnings for high school grads and understate earnings for college grads. Measured earnings are $60,000 for high school grads because one alleged high school grad went to college, and $90,000 for college grads because one alleged college grad didn't go to college. The true difference in earnings is $50,000. The true college premium is plus 100%. Yet, thanks to human error, the measured difference is only $30,000 and the measured premium is only plus 50%. This example illustrates a general principle. Mismeasurement of education shrinks the perceived education premium. Labor economists frequently correct for this distortion and conclude the true effect of education on income is about 10% larger than it looks on the surface. On closer look, however, their approach stacks the deck in education's favor. While labor economists often correct for mismeasurement of education to prevent competing variables from stealing credit for the effect of education, they rarely correct for mismeasurement of intelligence to prevent education from stealing credit for the effect of intelligence. They rarely correct for mismeasurement of personality to prevent education from stealing credit for the effect of personality. Indeed, they rarely correct for mismeasurement of anything other than education. As a result, labor economists bypass the crucial question, is education on net a victim or a thief? Do intelligence, personality, and so on steal more credit from education than education steals from them? The rare papers that face this challenge find measurement error is a red herring. The true effect of education on income is no bigger than it looks. The real rewards of education. The link between practical skill and worldly success is subtler than either mainstream defenders or contrarian detractors of modern education imagine. The skillful do a good job. The successful have a good job. Despite its weak effect on skill, education remains the modern economy's surest stairway to prosperity. If you personally know many wealthy dropouts and indigent college grads, you personally know many atypical people. Challenge the data all you like. Correct for brains, motivation, family background, choice of major, and beyond. The education premium will shrink before your eyes. Yet the shrinking stops long before the education premium disappears. Vocational majors are especially lucrative, but even archaeology degrees boost your income by 25%. Why would shrewd, money-grubbing employers pay such exorbitant rates for archaeologists? Education's contrarian detractors typically blame the government, but their stories fall flat. Government sinecures? The private sector pays more for education than the public sector. Regulation? The education premium in licensed and unlicensed jobs is roughly the same. Lawsuits, legal doctrine notwithstanding, the IQ test tax is a pittance. Contrarian detractors should stop avoiding the cleanest explanation. Signaling, going to school to certify skill can be as lucrative as going to school to enhance skill. If archaeology BAs are better workers than high school grads, employers needn't waste time wondering what useful skills do archaeology programs really teach. Instead, they'll skip to the bottom line. When I pay 25% extra for an archaeologist, I get my money's worth. End of story. Education's contrarian detractors and mainstream defenders have one illusion in common. Both think they can kill two birds with one stone. The detractors find little effect of education on job skills, so they ignore the evidence that education mightily enhances worldly success. The defenders find a large effect of education on worldly success, so they ignore the evidence that education barely enhances job skills. Both sides make strong cases as long as they stick to the evidence they know. The wise approach is to take all the evidence seriously. To understand education, we have to look at skill and success, learning and earning. Irrelevant education really is financially rewarding. Human capital purism can respond only with denial and dismay. The signaling model, thankfully, is ready, willing, and able to pick up the slack. Chapter 4. The Signs of Signaling. In case you're still not convinced. In short, whoever you may be, to this conclusion you'll agree. When everyone is somebody, then no one's anybody. W.S. Gilbert and Arthur Sullivan, The Gondoliers. In the modern world, your first quarter century of life is deeply weird. You spend your earliest years learning incredibly useful skills, how to walk, how to talk, how to get along with others, Everything's going so well until your parents decide you're old enough to start school. School teaches you a few more incredibly useful skills, reading, writing, math. Most of the day, though, you just kill time. Parents, teachers, and other adults guarantee that formal education is vital preparation for adult life. 13 years later, your elders grant you the option to quit school but urge you to finish at least 4 more years. The link between what you have to study in school and what you'll do on the job is an ongoing mystery. Yet when you finally graduate, the wisdom of your elders is undeniable. The better your transcript, the richer your opportunities in the labor market. When you have a weird experience, you doubt yourself. What's really weird, the world or you? The answer for education, as we've seen, is the world. Learning few useful skills in school and laughing all the way to the bank is normal. The signaling model of education elegantly rationalizes the weirdness. Signaling doesn't just reconcile the psychology of learning with the economics of earning. Once signaling clicks, your first quarter century of life finally makes sense. It fits our first-hand experience, and it's hard to imagine any other way to reconcile the facts about learning with the facts about earning. But does the evidence we've covered really justify this triumphalism? Many smart people remain skeptical, especially if they put little stock in first-hand experience. Indirect evidence about learning and earning isn't good enough for them. They want social science that directly confirms the power of educational signaling. This chapter serves these skeptics the social science they seek. 4 major research literatures spanning economics, psychology, and sociology explicitly or implicitly try to detect and measure educational signaling. Let's unpack the logic behind these 4 approaches and scrutinize what each reveals. The sheepskin effect. Suppose you're 1 class away from a BA. You're biking to the final exam, secure in your mastery of the coursework. Suddenly, a car smacks into you. Though your injuries are minor, you miss your test. The professor denies you a makeup, so you flunk the class and fail to graduate. Once your outrage cools, you weigh your options. Should you enroll for 1 more semester to complete your diploma or give up and get on with your life? The pure human capital model urges you to quit school. While your accident deprived you of a diploma, you still possess all the skills required to earn that diploma. Hiring you for a college graduate's job is usually perfectly legal. Since employers value skills, not diplomas, retaking your missing class would waste your time and money. The signaling model, in contrast, advises you to finish what you started. In our society, graduation is a sacred milestone. Graduation tells employers, I take social norms seriously and have the brains and work ethic to comply. Quitting tells employers, I scorn social norms or lack the brains and work ethic to comply. If you graduate, the signaling model says the market will lump you with the winners and pay you a special diploma bonus, often called a sheepskin effect, because diplomas used to be printed on sheepskin. If you quit, the signaling model says the market will lump you with the losers and withhold the sheepskin's reward. After all, employers won't know why you failed to finish your degree. They'll only know you failed. Labor economists normally neglect sheepskin effects. By default, they assume all years of education are created equal, then estimate the effect of a year of education on earnings. Yet economists who trouble to look almost always find pay spikes for diplomas. High school graduation has a big spike. 12th grade pays more than grades 9, 10, and 11 combined. In percentage terms, the average study finds graduation year is worth 3.4 regular years. College graduation has a huge spike. Senior year of college pays over twice as much as freshman, sophomore, and junior years combined. In percentage terms, the average study finds graduation year is worth 6.7 regular years. Results are similar for advanced degrees. In several studies, their payoff is nothing but a sheepskin effect. When pay spikes, so does education itself. Finish your degree, then rest on your laurels is the classic student strategy. One-third of the U.S. population spends 12 years in school, gets a high school diploma, then stops. Only 2% quit high school right after 11th grade. One-seventh spends 16 years in school, gets a bachelor's degree, then stops. Only 2% quit college right after their junior year. Signaling has an instant explanation for all the spikes. Why does pay spike for degree years? Because finishing sends employers a much better signal than quitting. Why does education spike for degree years? Because students run, walk, or crawl to grab the handsome cash prize they see just over the finish line. To get a better feel for the sheepskin effect, let's put workers in the General Social Survey, GSS, under the microscope. This massive survey of the U.S. public, begun in 1972, is still underway. The GSS is ideal for isolating sheepskin effects. 99.5% of participants declare both their years of education and their highest completed degree. Ignoring degrees, the GSS features a large education premium. Take another year of school, get a 10.9% raise. Correcting for degrees, however, this annual payoff plummets to 4.5%. Over 60% of the education premium turns out to be a sheepskin effect. High school and four-year college diplomas are especially lucrative. Crossing each of these thresholds boosts income by almost a third. As expected, the most lucrative years are also the most popular. 30% have a high school diploma with exactly 12 years of schooling. Only 5% finish 11 years, but not 12. 11% have a bachelor's degree with exactly 16 years of school. Only 3% finish their junior year, but not their senior year. In the good old days, when the reality of the sheepskin effect was still in doubt, economists took the sheepskin signaling connection for granted. Every paper that found sheepskin effects scored a point for signaling. Every paper that failed to find sheepskin effects scored a point for human capital. But now that the sheepskin effect is undeniable, some economists reinterpret the evidence to deny signaling a victory. How could sheepskin effects not reflect signaling? The simplest story is that schools save the best for last. Graduation years pay extra because that's when schools suddenly focus on marketable skills. As far as I know, no one defends this idea. Graduation year is goof-off year, not finally learn some job skills year. Most skeptics try to undermine the sheepskin signaling connection from a totally different angle, ability bias. Sure, graduation looks lucrative. Yet the reason, supposedly, is that graduates had far better career prospects than dropouts all along. If ability bias fully explains the sheepskin effect, an untimely bike accident that derails your graduation will leave your career unscathed. As usual, the best way to test for ability bias is to measure and correct for ability. Multiple papers on the sheepskin effect carry out such tests. None concludes that sheepskin effects vanish after correcting for ability. Instead, correcting for ability usually modestly cuts the effect of both years of education and diplomas, holding the relative payoff for diplomas steady. Results from the General Social Survey are typical. Standout result, the sheepskin effect for junior college falls by about a third. Otherwise, there's not much to see. Absolute payoffs for high school diplomas, bachelor's degrees, and graduate degrees barely budge, and their relative payoffs actually rise. Ability bias explanations for sheepskin effects aren't just hard to square with the statistical evidence. They're hard to square with the glaring fact that education spikes in degree years. If the labor market ignores credentials, why do so many high school grads opt for zero college? And so many college grads opt for zero graduate education. Are we supposed to believe one-third of the population has exactly the right ability to finish high school but not advance to college? One-seventh of the population has exactly the right ability to finish college but not advance to grad school? You could say college is far harder than high school, so many decent high school students reasonably expect to fail in college. Yet nowadays, high school and college curricula plainly overlap. About 40% of traditional undergraduates take at least one remedial course. True believers can always protest, the sheepskin effect shall vanish once we get better ability measures. Such forecasts, to be blunt, are empty promises. Sheepskin effects look massive. To debunk them, researchers would have to pinpoint fantastically potent yet neglected abilities. But that's not all. To debunk sheepskin effects, correcting for these neglected abilities would have to drastically cut the payoff for degrees, but not the payoff for years of schooling. What abilities would even conceivably qualify? After digesting all the evidence on the sheepskin effect, you may feel ready to channel King Solomon. Human capital and signaling come before you as litigants. They ask you to split the education premium between them, a ruling with a great ring to it. Human capital gets credit for the payoff for years of education. Signaling gets credit for the payoff for degrees. This implies a human capital signaling split of roughly 60-40 for high school and 40-60 for college. Yet on reflection, this Solomonic ruling treats human capital too generously. The sheepskin effect doesn't measure signaling. Instead, the sheepskin effect sets a lower bound on signaling. King Solomon should award signaling all the payoff for diplomas, plus some of the payoff for years of education, and hand human capital whatever's left. To see why, picture a world that lacks the notion of graduation. Can we safely declare educational signaling would vanish in such a world? Of course not. In the absence of diplomas, education continues to signal intelligence, conscientiousness, and conformity. The main difference between this imaginary world and our own, its signals are smooth. If you get slightly more education, you look slightly more employable. In the real world, we know what graduation is and view graduates and dropouts as separate species. This doesn't mean, however, that we ignore unfinished education. In our society, credentials define you in broad strokes, but years of education add valuable details. Consider this vignette. Jane got her high school degree and never went to college. Doris got her high school degree, finished a year of college, then quit school for good. Who do you hire? Suppose Doris learned no job skills in college. You would still expect her to be a better worker than Jane. Why? Because Jane met minimal social expectations while Doris surpassed them. If you want a worker who goes the extra mile, Doris is the better bet. We should not be surprised, then, that some sheepskin studies find solid rewards for the first year of college. In the eyes of the labor market, 'tis better to try and fail than never to have tried at all. If you live outside the ivory tower, research on the sheepskin effect may seem redundant. Normal people don't need research to know the labor market amply rewards graduation. They experience credentialism firsthand. If you live inside the ivory tower, research on the sheepskin effect may seem even more redundant. Professors dwell in one of the most credentialist habitats on the planet. They never hire people without suitable degrees. How can they wonder if diplomas really pay? Still, sheepskin scholarship has paid off. Modern life tells us the sheepskin effect is big, but only scholarship can tell us how big. It also inoculates us against the seductive view that diplomas no longer matter in the age of billionaire dropouts. Perhaps most importantly, sheepskin scholarship shows common sense and social science converge. You can scorn firsthand experience and still reach the obvious conclusion. Malemployment and credential inflation. Many workers have more education than they actually use. Laymen call them overqualified. Their education is too good for their jobs. Researchers often call them malemployed. Their jobs aren't good enough for their education. Yet the two ideas are the same. If your waiter has a PhD in astronomy, something somewhere has gone terribly awry. Researchers have three main measures of malemployment. There is the atypical education method. See if your education is abnormally high given your occupation. This method usually yields a 10-20% malemployment rate. The atypical education approach's main drawback, it rules out the possibility that the typical worker in an occupation is overeducated. If every bartender has a PhD, the atypical education approach reports 0% malemployment for bartenders. Then there is the self-report method. Researchers ask workers if they have too much, too little, or just enough education for their jobs. This method usually yields a 20 to 35% malemployment rate. The self-report approach's main drawback, calling yourself overqualified, is a bitter admission of failure, so true rates are likely higher. Finally, there is the job analysis method. After dissecting occupations one by one, researchers judge how much education the occupation really requires, then check whether workers' education exceeds this requirement. This method also usually yields a 20 to 35% malemployment rate. The job analysis approach's main drawback, skill requirements both rise and fall over time. Some innovations simplify once complex jobs. Other innovations complicate once simple jobs. Regardless of your preferred measure, all three approaches reveal abundant malemployment. This is a rare topic where economists and sociologists have a meeting of the minds. The only way to deny the ubiquity of malemployment is to dogmatically insist the education workers have is, by definition, the education workers need. Try telling that to a waiter with a PhD in astronomy. Most researchers agree malemployment is on the rise. One leading team found U.S. college grads' malemployment rate rose from 25.2% in 2000 to 28.2% in 2010. During the depths of the Great Recession, malemployment for the youngest college grads neared 40%. Another research team focused on the long-run evolution of education in 500 occupational categories. From the early 1970s to the mid-1990s, workers' average education rose by 1.5 years. About 20% of this increase, 0.3 years, reflected the switch to higher skill occupations. The remainder stemmed from credential inflation. Average education within individual occupations rose 1.2 years. A longer-run study for 1972 to 2002 gets nearly the same ratio. Average education rose by 1.75 years, but growth of higher-skilled jobs drove only 19% of the increase. Credential inflation has even ravaged academia itself. Today's professors are much more likely to have PhDs than they were in the 1960s. Despite clichés about the information age, workers are changing much more rapidly than their work. By itself, malemployment is compatible with the human capital model. How? Graduates could be malemployed because they failed to acquire marketable job skills in school. This might mean malemployed graduates failed to learn and retain the curriculum. Recall that on the National Assessment of Adult Literacy, over 50% of high school grads and almost 20% of college grads have less than intermediate literacy and numeracy. Or it might mean malemployed graduates learn an irrelevant curriculum. Recall that over 40% of high school coursework and over 40% of college majors score low in usefulness. When a BA bartender asks, "Why, oh why, can't I get a better job?" human capital bluntly answers, "Because, despite your credentials, you didn't learn how to do a better job." Signaling weaves a contrary tale. One where malemployment reflects workers' never-ending struggle to outshine each other. Picture the labor market as an arms race. Rising education automatically sparks credential inflation. As credentials proliferate, you must study harder and longer to convince employers to hire you. In an everyone has a BA dystopia, an aspiring janitor might need a master's in janitorial studies to land a job scrubbing toilets. When a BA bartender asks, "Why, oh why, can't I get a better job?" signaling ruefully answers, "Because too many competing workers have even more impressive credentials than you do." As two noted sociologists explain, in an overqualified labor market, employers will fill the highest jobs with those who have the highest credentials. Since overschooling means there are too many workers who are highly educated, some of these workers are necessarily allocated to mid-level jobs. This process is repeated for those with mid-level qualifications, where, since there are not enough mid-level jobs, many are forced to compete for low-level jobs. If both human capital and signaling allow for malemployment, Why raise the issue? Because the two stories diverge on one crucial point. Does the labor market reward workers for education they do not use? Human capital says no. Signaling says yes. Take bartenders with BAs. Plausibly assuming college does not transform students into better bartenders, the human capital model predicts BAs will fail to raise bartenders' income. The signaling model predicts the opposite. Bartenders with BAs will out-earn bartenders without BAs. Why? Because bars, like all businesses, seek intelligent, conscientious, conformist workers. And a BA signals these very traits. Given a choice, then, bars favor applicants with BAs despite the on-the-job irrelevance of the academic curriculum. How well does the labor market pay workers for education they do not use? The best data on this question, ironically, comes from enthusiastic promoters of college expansion. Researchers at Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce used the 2007-2009 American Community Survey to tabulate earnings by education level for over 250,000 workers in 500 occupational categories. Their data strongly confirm two patterns. First, high school grads out-earn high school dropouts in almost all occupations. Out of their 500 occupations, 214 include at least 10 high school dropouts and at least 10 high school grads. High school grads out-earn dropouts in 93% of these occupations, with a median earnings premium of plus 37%. Second, college grads out-earn high school grads in almost all occupations. Out of the same 500 occupations, 270 include at least 10 high school grads and at least 10 college grads. College grads out-earn high school grads in 90% of these occupations, with a median earnings premium of plus 28%. To weigh the power of human capital versus signaling, however, we must zero in on occupations with little or no plausible connection to traditional academic curricula. Despite many debatable cases, there are common jobs that workers clearly don't learn in school. Almost no one goes to high school to become a bartender, cashier, cook, janitor, security guard, or waiter. No one goes to a four-year college to prepare for such jobs. Yet, the labor market pays bartenders, cashiers, cooks, janitors, security guards, and waiters for high school diplomas and college degrees. None of these occupations are weird outliers. True, most bartenders, cashiers, cooks, janitors, security guards, and waiters lack college degrees. Yet in the modern economy, all are common jobs for college grads. More work as cashiers, 48th most common job for college grads, or waiters, 50th, than mechanical engineers, 51st. More work as security guards, 67th, or janitors, 72nd, than network and computer systems administrators, 75th. More work as cooks, 94th, and bartenders, 99th, than librarians, 104th. Human capital purists could insist college provides useful training for electricians, real estate agents, or secretaries, but even the staunchest fans of human capital theory struggle to state, college prepares the next generation of cashiers and janitors for their careers without smirking. Now, let's cast a wider net. Roughly one-third of occupations in the American Community Survey have at least 10 workers in each of the main education categories: high school dropouts, high school graduates, four-year college graduates. About one-third of these occupations at least arguably build on traditional academic coursework. The remaining occupations' tie to the academic curriculum is tenuous at best. Human capital theorists can draw comfort from the fact the college premium is almost twice as high for arguably academic occupations, but not too much comfort. The high school premium is slightly higher for non-academic occupations. When high school dropouts and college graduates are in the same line of work, college graduates typically earn 70 to 90% more, even in occupations high schools and colleges studiously ignore. What would King Solomon conclude about the human capital signaling split? The combined premium plainly reflects both human capital and signaling. The non-academic premium, in contrast, presumably reflects something close to pure signaling. What is signaling's share? The Solomonic verdict just divides the non-academic premium by the combined premium. This works out to nearly 100% signaling for high school and 80% for college. Why are academic credentials so lucrative even in decidedly non-academic lines of work? The Georgetown researchers who compiled this data proposed two conspicuously implausible options. A, employers are fools, or B, schooling greatly